Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I am Oren McIntyre, and I've got a stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So a lot of people have noticed that no matter how much I think the average church asks for immigration to stop, it seems like the church leadership is often out of step. We see this with recent remarks from the Pope. We see, you know, Catholics are sometimes mixed on this. And of course, evangelical leaders often also seem obsessed with the idea of facilitating open borders, even though their church members are often opposed to it. I wanted to dive a little bit into the politics and the infrastructure that is often used to facilitate illegal immigration and other left-wing priorities, even though the majority of Christians seem to push back against them. Joining me to do that today is the Daily Wire's Megan Bashman. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. You're actually writing a larger book about this, which we'll talk about at a later time. But I wanted to have you on because I know that you delve into much of this. And I'm somebody, obviously, who's paying attention to politics at a pretty regular basis. But it can be a lot to focus on what's going on with the church and the different organizations, the NGOs, everything, all the moving pieces involved with that. Because at this point, these massive denominations and organizations have in many ways become governments unto themselves. And it can be difficult to tell what kind of movements and who's pushing back against who and what direction kind of the zeitgeist is taking it. But I think the good place to start before we kind of get into anything else is, why does it feel like there's this disconnect between leadership and the average churchgoer, especially in the evangelical realm? I think most evangelicals are compassionate towards illegal immigrants. They understand why they would come across the border. They don't want them to be hurt or anything like that. But they also feel a sense of, this is my country. And at the end of the day, while these might be Christians and brothers and sisters, that doesn't entitle them to come into my home and have access to, you know, the services that are paid for by people in this country. Why does there seem to be a disconnect between them and the leadership?
Because there is a massive disconnect between them and the leadership. And a lot of that was very deliberately orchestrated, and it's an ongoing deliberate orchestration. I think we can talk about to a certain degree that it's kind of the respectable establishment position to take to be pro pathways to citizenship and things like that. I mean, obviously we know that's Chamber of Commerce, elite Republicanism. So I think there's certainly a certain level of wanting to align with that when you are upwardly aspirational and you wanna be seen as being a part of that white glove crowd. So that's part of it. But then there's also a very deliberate effort that happened here. And I always kind of wanna start these conversations by telling people who aren't religious or who are kind of nominally Christian, but maybe they're not very involved in a church, like, why do I care about this? It's important to know why you care about the evangelicals, even if you're not one of them, or, you know, you don't are particularly active in your church. And it's because they are around 32% of the electorate, and they are well known as the GOP's strongest base. The Atlantic has rightly called them America's most powerful voting bloc. So I would say that, you know, in decades past, there was something of a really strong oppositional position that the left took towards evangelicals. And that shifted around 10 years ago when you started to see some of these big left-wing foundations say, okay, instead of opposing them, how do we start to co-opt them? And I mean, you can see in organizations like George Soros's Open Society Foundation, his director of US programs at that time, a guy named Bill Vandenberg, actually writes in a memo to other principals in that organization for US programs, hey, we're not going to move our legislative priorities down the field if we don't find a way to engage religious Americans. This isn't going to go away. So we really have to rethink our tactics about how we approach them. So I would say that was where you really started to see this, was right around 2012, 2013, with the Gang of Eight bill. And at that point, you saw major left-wing secular foundations like Open Society, like the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Tides Foundation, all start kind of pouring money into organizations that were working with what I would call evangelical front groups. So the National Immigration Forum is one of the largest and best known. It's known as being left-wing, but what they specifically did was create a front group called the Evangelical Immigration Table. And they brought in a whole bunch of religious leaders to affect essentially trickle down influence. So, hey, if all of our big religious leaders are for this, then that's the Christian thing to do. We better get on board with that position as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into this subversive aspect, because it's very clear, like you said, that these people still hate Christians. Like the left is very clear about, you know, that the white evangelical Christian is the worst thing they could possibly imagine. It's the, you know, it is Satan incarnate for them, or whatever the atheist version of that would be. And so, like, these are people they clearly hate, but they also have gone out of their way to slowly infiltrate these organizations and sway opinion. And I want to talk about that shift in why, how they're playing both sides of that. But before we get to all that, guys, let me tell you really quickly about today's sponsor, ISI. Universities today aren't just neglecting real education, they're actively undermining it. And we can't let them get away with it. America was made for an educated and engaged citizenry. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute is here to help. ISI offers programs and opportunities for conservative students across the country. ISI understands that conservatives and right-of-center students feel isolated on college campuses, and that you're often fighting for your own reputation, dignity, and future. Through ISI, you can learn about what Russell Kirk called the permanent things, the philosophical and political teachings that shaped and made Western civilization great. ISI offers many opportunities to jumpstart your career. They have fellowships at some of the nation's top conservative publications like National Review, The American Conservative, and The College Thinker. If you're a graduate student, ISI offers funding opportunities to sponsor the next great generation of college professors. Through ISI, you can work with conservative thinkers who are making a difference, thinkers like Chris Rufo, who currently has an ISI researcher helping him with his book. But perhaps most importantly, ISI offers college students a community of people that can help them grow. If you're a college student, ISI can help you start a student organization or a student newspaper, or meet other like-minded students at their various conferences and events. ISI is here to educate the next generation of great Americans. To learn more, go to isi.org. That's isi.org. And before we dive right back into it, guys, I do want to remind you that we are coming up on election season, which means, of course, we're coming up on censorship season. You know that big tech is going to be striking every video they can. They're going to be demonetizing. They're going to be taking down everything they can. Whenever we get close to something like this, you saw what happened in 2000. They just try to shut down everything. Make sure you guys can't hear about it. So if you want to be able to continue to support this channel, if you want to be able to continue to support all of the people who are plugged into the Blaze and who are allowed to speak through Blaze News and the Blaze TV platform, then go ahead and go to blazetv.com, and you can use my promo code Oren to go ahead and get $20 off your subscription. That way we can continue to keep talking to you, even if big tech tries to take down shows like this one. All right. So Megan, you were talking about the subversive aspect, right? A lot of evangelicals, I think, instinctually understand, again, that compassion towards the immigrant, but also understand that there has to be rule of law, there has to be limitations, there has to be a way to go ahead and limit and vet who's coming in for the safety, security, and just prosperity of the nation. But it does feel like there has been a very concerted effort, and as you laid out there at the beginning, there are these front groups that have been set up. It also, it seems that there have been a large number of NGOs are being used. So it's not just that they're influencing church leadership. You know, they're not just, okay, we're going to gather these people together, we're going to kind of give them this credential and use that to influence the opinion of the average evangelical. But there's also these large organizations that are funneling the time, effort, the ministry dollars of evangelical Christians. And they're directly going to undermine border security and make sure that illegal immigrants make the trip across.
Right. And that's a really important aspect of this. And I think it's important also to note that this is all kind of incestuous. So if you take a group like World Relief, they're one of their vice presidents of communications also sits on the board, I think, of Evangelical Immigration Table. He's like their national director, this guy, Matthew Sorens. So you see them sitting on the one side, okay, we're working for this NGO, which is getting tens of millions of dollars from the federal government to help facilitate illegal immigration. I would say, you know, what they do is they sort of help people claim asylee status. And we know that that's become a cute little game that if you can just get across the border, then you claim you're an asylee. And at that point, they argue, well, you're not an illegal immigrant because you may have crossed the border illegally, but you claimed asylum. So now you're here legally because you're waiting to be processed. So at the same time that these guys get, you know, huge contracts and grants from the federal government, they're also sitting on the boards of these organizations that, and I do want to be specific because you brought this up, that it's not just about ministering to illegal immigrants or any immigrants who happen to come here. In fact, it's not about that at all. That's not what they do. What they do is lobby for legislation. So you don't see them releasing curriculum into churches to say, you know, here's how to help people on the ground who may need a job or, you know, may need clothing or food or shelter. That's not what they do. What they do is try to teach church members how to lobby for legislation. It's very specific. So when you, yeah, sorry.
No, keep going.
So what they do, and then you seeing them on both sides of the border, and I think it's also important to know that they don't always know, I think, some of the heads of these organizations. Like, it was interesting to look at Samaritan's Purse and Franklin Graham, and I watched him give an interview, I think it was on News Nation, where he said, hey, we don't have anything to do with this UN program that is passing out debit cards to people on their way from like Venezuela across the Darien Gap. We're not involved in that. And then later it came out that they were. And I actually asked some experts, hey, listen, is it possible that Franklin Graham didn't know that his organization was involved with that? Because it has so many tentacles into so many different organizations. And I was told, yeah, it's absolutely possible. A lot of times people really don't know how deep the tentacles go. And they don't always know all the ways that they're partnering either with the federal government or with the UN or with some of these left-wing foundations.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to understand that, like you said, there are plenty of people who are probably acting in good faith who do want to help people out, and they simply don't understand the extent or how complicit they're being in different steps of this process. The need of our ruling class to just continuously move people into the United States, it seems rather compulsive, and they are more than willing to involve well-meaning organizations that otherwise would be used to go ahead and better people here in the United States, care to administer to the people here in order to go ahead and subvert the laws of the United States. And I think that a lot of the guys, you know, I've seen church ministries, I've been around when this has happened, you know, people, oh, okay, we're packing lunches, we're preparing, you know, to help for natural disaster victims. And then they find out halfway through the process, well, half of this is going to natural disaster victims, but the other half is going to people who have been brought across the border by coyotes. And yeah, those people, you know, obviously they're in a need, but you're actively facilitating a process of human trafficking by delivering, you know, material to these people. A lot of this is like in Africa, where the foreign aid goes there, right? Oh, we're giving foreign aid. No, you're actually just facilitating a dictatorship. None of this is going to the people. This is just allowing the guys who otherwise might have to feed their people, might have to take care of them, to take all of the money that they would otherwise use to care for the starving people and recirculate it back into their dictatorship, buy more arms, buy, you know, whatever, sell the medicine at a price. And this is the kind of thing that happens with a lot of these organizations. They're trying to do good. They're trying to take care of people who otherwise might be starving or, you know, might not have a meal or medical care. And what they end up doing is actually just being a substitution. They're just subsidizing the care for these people who otherwise would probably not come across the border or not be able to because they have access to that care once they're across.
Right. And let's be clear that in a lot of times, it's not that they're in any particular danger or that they would not be able to pursue a good life in somewhere like South America. It's just that, well, America's better. So if I can get to the United States, I would rather do that. So, I mean, I think there's this perception that we're talking about people who are in dire straits, and that's often not the case. And not just that, I mean, it's important to look at what is the return on investment here. And you can, I think the estimate has been something like you can help 10 times as many people on the ground in those countries as you can bringing someone here. So it would actually be a lot more effective as far as altruism goes to say, let's minister to and help those people in their countries rather than trying to get them across the border here as refugees, for example. But I also don't want to be like too charitable to some of these groups, because at one time, I think, you know, there were some noble aims, but over time, when those big government grants keep coming, your purpose becomes to continue to see those government grants. And so now you're just sort of a lobbying arm for ensuring that you have a reason to exist. And so they are importing, you know, new voters, new workers. I mean, this is very much Chamber of Commerce policy. The National Immigration Forum is pretty open about the fact that we are here to help create a new workforce. So we know what that does to wages. We know what that does to housing prices. We know that it's not good for a lot of our neighbors. And yet it's all brought in under the rubric of Christians have to support this to love your neighbor, even though in so many cases, it's actually harmful to their actual neighbors living right next door to them.
So I want to ask you about that too, right? Because this is something I hear all the time from people is like, well, you know, I heard the story of the Good Samaritan. And so everybody's my neighbor. And so therefore I can't prefer the people close to me. Like I can't, like I have to treat, you know, an illegal immigrant exactly the same way and prioritize them at the same way that I prioritize my neighbor. And I think that's a really, really dangerous understanding of Christian teaching. I don't think that's the indication at all of the implication at all. And when you do this, not only are you, I think you, you know, subverting the teachings of Christ, you're also opening yourself up to be taken advantage of by some of the worst people in the world. You have to understand, like you said, that the you know, the commission is first to your own nation and then to others. It's to, you take care of your neighbor and then you take care of others. You don't skip over the people next to you and their well-being in the hope of caring for someone who has been brought in illegally, violating your laws in a very dangerous situation to subvert your national integrity.
You know, there was a character in, I can't remember which Charles Dickens novel it is off the top of my head, but it's a mother who has a whole bunch of children and she entirely neglects her children in order to do all this missions work that makes her feel really good about herself. And so her children are neglected. They're doing terribly. And the joke that Dickens makes throughout it is this woman views herself as so charitable because she's involved in all this church missions work, and yet her children are struggling and ignored. And I think that's what we see right now from our government. And it's also really important to go, okay, Christ's command to love your neighbor or to act as the Good Samaritan was not a government policy. It's not saying this is how the government, the federal government needs to employ its immigration policy. And that's how it's being used. And that really is an abuse of scripture. And so when we see that, that's kind of why I like to emphasize for people, when you dive into these organizations like the Evangelical Immigration Table, you need to know that that's not even what they're doing anyway. They're not just seeing someone suffering on the side of the road and saying, hey, we should help them. Because I think any Christian sees that and goes, yeah, I agree with that. If I see someone who crosses my path that is suffering, I'm going to help them. But it doesn't mean that we now create a mechanism for suffering in my path. And it also doesn't mean that I am obligated to hurt other neighbors to help that neighbor. And that's kind of what they're arguing, I mean, unequivocally. And when they do that, they're not actually giving food to that person there either, because that's not the purpose of these organizations. Their explicit purpose is to lobby for legislation. It's why they were created. It's what they do. They are lobbying for bills. So this is explicitly political activity. And that's very different than just ministering. And it's also very different than spreading the gospel, because let's be very clear, when you have a group like, say, World Relief or any of these other religious NGOs, they sometimes very carefully in their language kind of suggest to the people who are getting involved with this work or who are giving money to their work, we're spreading the gospel of Christ. No, they're not. They're barred by law from doing that. So they're not, when they're bringing people in at the border and helping them get resettled, they're not telling them about Jesus because they're not allowed to do that.
I like the phrase, the mechanism of bringing suffering into my path. I think that's that's an important one for people to keep in mind as they're thinking about these issues. So you talked about how the government grants necessarily shift the way these institutions structure themselves and their incentive structure. This is, I don't know if you're familiar with conquest laws, but that absolutely dovetails into that natural leftward pull of organizations. I wonder then, a lot of people have been talking about, of course, Christian nationalism. And I'm sympathetic to many of the aims of Christian nationalism, though I have some problems with philosophically and just rhetorically with the title. But I wonder if they don't understand maybe the consequences then of a structuring where the government is working as hand in hand with these organizations. Is that a cautionary tale, or is it simply the orientation of the government where the government was already operating under the understanding of the good of the people and the true Christian good, would they just be a helpful partner to Christian organizations? Or should we be very careful about the way that we kind of pair government funding with Christian organizations, lest they always be subverted in this way?
Well, look, I think any time that you're tying government funding to a religious organization, the religious organization needs to watch its back for what's going to be required of it eventually, because we have seen this, right, with religious schools, is suddenly, you know, you accept some type of even government loans for students who attend your schools. It now thinks it gets a right to say who you can admit and who you hire and what Title VII, Title IX, all other kinds of regulations you have to follow. So there's no, the federal government doesn't give you money and then just back away and say, do your thing. You know, we're just here to fund you a little bit. It doesn't do that. And so, yes, one, I do think that that is always a danger if you're going to take money from the government. But then I also think there's this. There is the fact that when you take that money, your mission is by nature going to drift. But for some reason, that's a Christian nationalism, if you want to call it that, that they're okay with. So we're okay with saying these religious organizations are going to lobby for policy specifically. Let's take something like the Southern Baptist Convention, which I think represents, by some estimates, up to 5% of the population. They have a lobbying arm that at the same time that it's out saying, hey, Christian nationalism is really dangerous and you need to look out for these people who are saying, how do we bring our morals to bear on questions like, say, transgender policy in various states? So they argue for pluralism in that case. But when it's things like what we do about immigration, then we have a biblical mandate to lobby for specific legislation. So there's an obvious hypocrisy there. And I don't quite understand how they get around that. And I don't understand how I see guys like former ERLC head Russell Moore, who's now the editor in chief of Christianity Today. I don't get how he appears in a Rob Reiner movie warning about Christian nationalism, but at the same time takes a leadership role in organizations like the Evangelical Immigration Table, saying, because of our Christian morals, we have to lobby our legislators to pass this certain legislation. Like and it's on issues that are not nearly as clear, right? Something like how do we handle our border policies is very biblically debatable. Something like, should we mutilate children? Not biblically debatable. So
it's almost like his application of when Christians should care about politics is just aligned with power and has nothing to do with, you know, but with the understanding of what the Bible actually says about a biblical nation and the way that it would be influenced when making its laws.
Almost like.
Yeah. So the Pope recently came out said, and every time I say something the Pope says, I will eventually have a bunch of Catholics screaming like, the media lied, that's not what he said. But I'm pretty sure this is what he said, guys. So I'm just going to go ahead and broach this topic. He said that closing the border was terrible, that you can't close the border and turn people away. He said once they're here, you can decide whether or not they should be here and turn them around. But he said to close the border to illegal immigrants was inhumane. And I wonder if this is not a constant trick that we play. I have no, to be clear, I don't know if Pope Francis understands the mechanical problem that he's kind of stepping into. He's rather old. Maybe he's just not aware. But I have a feeling he might be aware. And when you have someone, as you already said, after they cross in, once they're in the system, sending them back becomes 1,000 times more difficult. The physical crossing of the border, once that's done, 90% of the work is done, because they know that they're going to be able to apply for asylum. There's going to be a million people there to subvert the system. Is it that Christians generally, or missing Christian leaders, just don't understand the manipulation of the procedural outcomes that ensures this process will eventually move in the favor of illegal immigration, or are they actually counting on that and just selling it to their constituents, their parishioners as people, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, once they get here, we can just turn them around.
I don't buy into the idea that anyone's so naive. I don't really even think the Pope is that naive that, oh, you know, it's just let them in and then we can sort it out once they're here. I mean, everyone knows it doesn't work that way. Essentially, what we eventually have is the, you know, the Reagan deal that we made. Well, okay, we're just going to legalize them just this one more time. And then 10, 20, 30 years down the road, we're getting, hey, can we just Gang of Eight bill? Can we just do it one more time? And we get the Lankford bill 10 years down the road, one more time. And I think people caught wise to that, which is why you have the evangelical base opposing it, because they don't really buy that anymore. And that's why there's been this something of an astroturf effort to try to convince them that now it's not just solving the problem. Now it's a Christian mandate that you have to support this. So, I mean, I think that's why we see it. When I look at the guys who are the religious leaders of this, I think there's some who just go with it because, hey, all my pastor friends and, you know, big Christian book author friends are signing this letter, so I'm going to sign it too. I do see that. But I think the guys who are leading these organizations, who, you know, sit on the boards, who are very well known to be the faces of this effort, someone like a Russell Moore or his replacement now, a guy named Brent Leatherwood, who's running the ERLC, Shirley Hoekstra of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, they know. I really have a hard time after everything that I've seen believing that they don't understand what they're doing because they are so specifically pushing that legislation. And then if you go back and you look at, okay, there is no legal separation between the left-wing National Immigration Forum and the Evangelical Immigration Table. As far as we can tell, they are legally the same entity. They were several years ago, they admitted that. And as I look into all of their corporate records, nothing seems to have changed. So they seem to still be the same organization. So they certainly know that they're a part of a left-wing organization. They certainly know what that organization's aims are and why the National Immigration Forum says we want to bring in more workers. I mean, they've been very clear that they partner with the Chamber of Commerce and some of these other groups to say, we want cheap labor. So I don't believe that they're so naive that they don't know that. And then there's also the fact that, look, they know who supports them. I mean, they know that they're taking money from La Raza, from Rockefeller, from Soros, from Tides. I mean, these are the organizations that fund the National Immigration Forum. So why would the Evangelical Table think that the National Immigration Forum has so much interest in forming this body and getting their materials out to churches? I mean, they, you know, they created whole campaigns on welcoming the stranger and putting out radio ads and church curriculum and things like that. So, you know, the guys at the top of this, it's clearly very orchestrated and it's clearly very subversive.
When I was a kid, obviously the media has always been against Christians, or at least has been for my entire life. And they made it very, it was very easy for them to kind of show the religious right as this big bad guy, right? That wielded all this power, had all this influence. And they put out all these propaganda films and TV shows and things about people fighting the censorship of the religious right. And, you know, I think that over time, you know, it's become very clear that if anything, the religious right really undersold the danger of the slippery slope and where we would end up. So obviously on the issues, the religious right was correct pretty much 1,000%. If anything, probably too timid about that. But the confusing thing is that what, you know, they were sold as this big cultural force over my entire childhood. It's very clear that in the last like 10 years or so, like you said, the entire leadership has been subverted very quickly. It feels like. And I wonder, do you feel like this was always a paper tiger? Was the religious right ever really in opposition to the powers that be? And if so, how did they so quickly get subverted and turned into this left-wing organization? Because it feels like consistently what we see is that Christians are simply just not able, especially conservative Christians, are not able to maintain control of their own organizations. They just are continuously subverted with very minimal effort. And I just wonder if that was always the case and it was just held up as a paper tiger, or if there was something that particularly kind of shook up the leadership that allowed for this quick entryism into Christian organizations to turn them into the kind of these immigration mills.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, you know, I mean, I might disagree a little bit just as far as the rank and file go, because they have been pretty effective at batting back immigration legislation and seeing those bills that, for example, the Gang of Eight, the Lankford bill. I mean, when you look at what they were told, if you look at the legislators, like I think Lankford really thought like he had the backing, because you have groups like the evangelical, and they put out polling. They're like, oh, we commissioned this polling, and this polling shows all the evangelicals really want this kind of reform. They want a pathway to citizenship. So then you have a guy like Lankford who partners with Schumer and goes forward to try to put this bill, and he gets smacked right in the face with it and seems shocked that it happened. And you saw the exact same thing happened 10 years ago with the McCain bill. Like, they all seemed really surprised because the evangelical leadership told them, no, we've got support for this. They really want this. Christianity Today runs headlines saying this evangelical immigration table commissioned a poll shows that evangelicals want these policies, but they're the largest constituency of the GOP base. And then turns out they don't. And Lankford has to slink away, you know, having had his head handed to him. And so I think on a certain level, they have been effective at that, at specific legislation. So it feels like they lose a lot of cultural battles and then win some legislative battles. And then the bureaucratic state finds a way to get around it anyway. And that's kind of what we see again and again. As far as the leadership, one, I think there is a perpetual, I'm trying to think how to charitably put it, but there's always sort of a chip on the evangelical shoulder that we are not the intellectuals and the blue bloods that you see from this other kind of power base in Washington. And maybe there's just always a real flattery offensive that they're just so grateful to be at the table, right? Like when you see Rick Warren running out touting that he got invited to Davos, or, you know, the Council of Foreign Relations has included him. There always just seems to be this gratitude that they get to be at the table. And so I think that that's part of it, is that then you start to amass, you look at somebody like Russell Moore. Well, now he's a Trinity Forum fellow, and now he's this other kind of fellow. And it is this very champagne ministry kind of thing where now they're rubbing shoulders. You know, these are guys who, you know, come from red states, and they've been called backward Southerners all their lives, and suddenly they're being seen as real intellectuals and they're being taken seriously. And so I think that is a heady elixir for them. And then I also think that there are some explicitly transactional things happening where, hey, we're going to give you a job as the head of this organization. And as you're moving up, you're going to reap some pretty big rewards, not just, you know, a salary as the head of something, but also book sales. We're going to promote you all over. You've suddenly got new book deals. You've got new speaking and conference engagements that you didn't have before. So I think all of that kind of feeds into it. And it's just a way of capturing these individuals. And look, this isn't a secret either. This isn't like me saying, this is kind of my theory about what's going on here. You can actually look at something like New America, which is a think tank that is partially Soros funded, and all the other usual suspects fund this group. And they have done analysis. They are left wing. And they're like, how do we capture the evangelicals? And they will talk about that. This is their approach, that, hey, we're going to sort of wine and dine and flatter them and hope that this trickle-down influence occurs. And they call it the rent an evangelical model, built after the rent a general model. We're going to co-opt one of them and send them out onto all the TV shows. And I don't even know, and I'll stop after this because I don't want to ramble, but I don't even know that the evangelical base is their ultimate audience. I think they're just trying to convince, in many cases, a Lankford or a Mike Johnson or someone like that, hey, we're going to cover you and we're going to make sure you have the ground level support to do what you're doing. So, you know, to a certain extent, it's almost like if we can just get the ball that far down the field, then we can maybe get close enough to kick this goal and keep the fans in the stands from running down onto the field and tackling us.
Do you think part of this problem, and of course this, you know, immigration is our focus here, but this could just wildly impact all of, I think, American culture. It seems like, you know, obviously we had a WASP aristocracy in the United States for a very long time. And this is what defined our institutions. This is more or less how we ended up, kind of with the culture that we had, also informed many of our immigration policies and how we wanted America to be formed for a long time. But kind of post the Ellis Island swing, it feels like while the WASPs waned in their power, in many ways it felt like they handed it away more than anything else, and evangelicals became probably the more energetic Christian force inside the United States, they never captured the status-making institutions that went along with that shift. And demographically, we saw, you know, Catholicism and others really kind of come in and sweep in a big way. And so now the Supreme Court, you know, try getting a, you know, evangelical Christian on the Supreme Court at this point, right? You don't see a lot of that anymore. And just in general, you never see the evangelicals actually capture these institutions that confer status, confer benefits. And so when you have an evangelical leader who wants to feel like they're plugged in, wants to feel like they're on the ascent, part of the ruling class, they have to come, like you said, kind of begging, hat in hand, to someone else, some other force, some other cultural force, in order to have those benefits conferred onto them. Do you think there's anything to that, the fact that evangelicals never ascended to those halls of power in the same way, as to why it was easy to shift the opinions of at least the leadership class inside the evangelical movement?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that is a part of it. And I also think, though, you do have that conquest law, that they do establish institutions that over time do become prestigious and well-recognized. And then as soon as they start to make that turn, you just see the same old leftist capture of them. They become attractive enough that the young intellectuals who, you know, maybe grew up evangelical, but have something of a despising my church back home thing and wanting to distance themselves from the rabble that they grew up with, start to take these organizations in different directions. I mean, if you look at something like, if you're familiar with the Trinity Forum, which has now become an explicitly never Trump think tank, but this think tank that is, you know, now traveling in those blue blood circles did not start out that way. Oz Guinness founded it, I think, in the 90s. And, you know, he is an intellectual, but he was a true Christian intellectual that really did try to keep it separate from politics. It was about higher things. And he defines himself as evangelical. And now you look at what Trinity Forum has become since Oz Guinness stepped down. It was like immediately the former, I think she was the speechwriter to Laura Bush, came in, or chief of staff to Laura Bush came in, and it became sort of an extension of this Bush blue blood conservatism. And that entire organization was entirely co-opted. And you see something very similar with Christianity today. So yes, I think there is a desire to be in those organizations to say, if we can get a seat at those tables, then we also are prestigious and elite and respected. But they also sort of serve up the organizations that we already have. So when we do start to build one, they kind of give them away when they get the chance. You see that with Christianity today. I mean, that was Billy Graham. I don't think anybody looks at Billy Graham as a particular elitist. And yet you look at what's happened to that magazine today, it is the voice of, it's almost mainline now in its voice, right? So it's almost like when you see the things that they write about and the preoccupations, they keep a very, very almost like lip service tone as far as sexual morality, but they write about it as little as possible. They certainly don't get involved on the ground level, red state bills, some of the executive power that's being wielded. They find that icky. So they write a lot of articles about pluralism and things of that nature. And it's almost like when we do have a successful organization, those guys come in and they give it away.
So I want to ask you this, and I, to be fair, I have an opinion because I wrote a book on it, but I want to float this to you since this is relevant to our current question. My theory is that the enemy is scale, and that actually you cannot organize meaningfully certain types of organizations beyond a particular point without them being subverted and becoming institutionally left wing. And I think this is why, especially when it comes to Christianity, we've seen this huge shift. You can't go to a church beyond a couple hundred members and not notice that all of a sudden the people in charge look a lot more like CEOs than they do ministers, that everybody has shifted in, you know, their focus from the preaching of God's word and the application of it practically to individual people into like figuring out, you know, what kind of spreadsheet will best explain the amount of even evangelism we're doing, the numbers we can pump up, the way we can break down the metrics and apply all these things. But once you start moving into bureaucratic systematic thinking, once you start kind of approaching people in this way, you necessarily will shift in a particular direction. And I wonder what you think about the possibility of the fact that many of our Christian organizations have attempted to scale up in this way and centralize necessarily makes them victim to this mentality of they will eventually basically adopt the attitudes of the managerial class, and those managerial attitudes and understandings of how to handle people, approach people, and acquire status will eventually pull their organization in a left-wing direction.
I mean, yeah, that seems to be the case. I mean, you go even all the way back to like Machen, you don't really see those institutions. He had to go found something new, and now that thing has gone left wing. So you don't ever really see them come back, except for there are a couple of outstanding examples. And Southern Baptist Convention was famously one of them for its conservative resurgence in the 80s and 90s. Really unusual. Why that happened in that case is something that I think needs to be studied a lot more. Like, how were they able to pull that back from the brink when it's so very unusual? And I think what we're seeing right now is COVID arrested some of that in the church in a shocking way that I don't think we would have seen without COVID. Like, I think COVID pulled the mask away of what you're describing in such a way that suddenly a lot of people sat up shocked and said there was such widespread failure that we are shocked to find out how we are not represented by our religious leadership. So there's a revolt happening right now that wouldn't have happened without COVID. And if COVID doesn't happen, does everyone still respect these publications like the Gospel Coalition or something who are leaning into the very cycle that you're describing? I think probably so. And I think that someone described it to me as it's almost like they have an assembly line of sweater vests and MDivs, and these are the only people who are respected. And it is such an elitist pose. And I'm trying to think, what do you do about it, right? In a fallen world, how do you keep that from happening? And I honestly don't know that I have an answer to it, other than it's almost like we have to embrace that Martin Luther spirit of combativeness. But at the same time, we're like, we want to be gentle. We want to, you know, not bring disunity. But I think that the default is always kindness, right? And the default is always, you know, don't stir up division. And yet this keeps happening because the division isn't stirred. And so maybe there just needs to be, you know, a greater theology of when is division necessary and when is separation necessary? And I think we don't talk about that enough. I think there's so much about how to be kind, how to be unified, that there's just really not enough talk about, okay, so when is it worth it to just boldly confront people to their face? Because when that happens, you see, like, you're already seeing it in the Southern Baptist Convention. Like, it has been weird to me in the last 2 years going, all of these guys who have been very squishy for a long time are suddenly posting like super based content. And I'm like, what's happening here? Like, how did y'all just spin on a dime? And in one sense, I'm welcoming it because I'm like, okay, so y'all sense that a new wind is blowing and you're trying to get out ahead of it. But I'm also kind of going, without COVID, I don't think we get here.
There is an uncomfortable truth that I think that a lot of people need to embrace, which is the fact that like most people, even though they're sincere, perhaps, you know, will ultimately follow where the wind takes them. They will go with the zeitgeist. And so it really matters who's in control of that zeitgeist. And if you want to hold people accountable, you really ultimately need to be able to be in control of kind of where that is moving. And that doesn't mean that every individual who kind of follows that path is duplicitous. It doesn't mean they're a terrible person. It's just how people are. You know, and you need to become more comfortable with the fact that kind of elite opinion and power tend to lead people in the directions that they go. And so if people feel like power in the SBC is heading a particular direction, then they will line up that direction. And that, you know, maybe that doesn't make everyone terrible. That just makes them human. But before we get to the questions of the people, which are starting to stack up here, I just want to ask you one more thing. David French obviously was invited to the Presbyterians, I believe it's the PCA, meeting. He was going to be a speaker in I believe one of these panels, and there was such a backlash that he was disinvited. Is that heartwarming for you? Does that give you some hope that the subversion isn't always complete? Like you said, you could have pushback and things like the Southern Baptists, where you see guys like this who otherwise would have been able to pass themselves off as, you know, one of the good Christians and just moving on everyone towards hope and unity when they're actually just there to obviously subvert. Do you think that response because of kind of the backlash is heartening in the direction that some of these denominations could be taking?
Yes, it was. And I'll tell you, it wasn't even so much about David French. It was about seeing that particular argument of, hey, let's be kind, let's be unifying. He's been invited. Because you did see that. You saw them pushing like, hey, you saw people just, it's rude to not let this really divisive, polarizing figure come to our church gathering and lecture us about divisiveness. And it was another one of those sort of managerial class moments where I think those who were in the leadership of the PCA, and I'm not a Presbyterian, so I don't know it in depth, but my sense of it, knowing a lot of them and talking to a lot of them, was that the stated clerk who was running this thing was shocked himself to see the backlash that he got. Because I think that, you know, pre-COVID David French, the assumption was a lot of people might have disagreed with him, but it would have been unseemly to speak out against having him. And so I think they didn't realize, hey, we're in a new moment, and people were much more willing to speak up and say, no, we don't want to hear from that guy anymore. We've heard plenty enough from that guy. And I'll be honest with you, if Tim Keller were still alive, this might have played out differently. I think he was a major figure for saying that we have to reach the cities, we have to reach the elite. And it's interesting. I'm very curious what might have happened if Tim Keller had still been with us to maybe rally the managerial class troops and tamp down on some of the backlash. But between that and COVID, I think people were just done.
Interesting. All right. Well, guys, we're going to switch over to the questions of the people here real quick, the super chats. Before we do, Megan, can you tell people, I know you got a book coming out soon, so you can tell them about that and where to find the rest of your work.
Yes. So new book is Shepherds for Sale, How Evangelical Leaders Traded the Truth for a Leftist Agenda. And I go into a lot of this in a lot more depth and on a number of subjects, from immigration to Me Too to climate change to all kinds of hijinks that a lot of left-wing leaders have been getting up to in the church. And you can always find me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram, I guess X now. I'm on X, but I'm at Meg Basham. And that's where I tend to fritter away and waste most of my time and procrastinate and curse. So come see me there.
I'm always calling it Twitter. They can't make me call it anything else.
I know.
They can correct it as many times as they want. I'm calling it Twitter forever. All right. So Florida Henry says, is this another case of managerialism corrupting the church? I've dealt with Americans with NGOs overseas, and they hate the U.S. Yeah, I totally believe that American NGOs hate the U.S. That would be a pretty easy thing to believe. But yeah, I think we kind of already touched on it some, but definitely a case of managerialism in the church, Megan.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And here's the good. I mean, well, it's bad news, but it's also like, look, this isn't new. We've been here before. So the church always prevails in the end.
That's true. Yeah. Not the first time I've heard the story of the structure of organized church overruling and trying to overtake something that God's trying to do and failing in that sense. Let's see. Gregory says, Christ took it for granted that people would love themselves and their friends. Modern self-loathing is at best an extreme overreaction to Christ's command to love enemies, if not a contradiction. Yeah, it is a strange thing. I think people have a hard to, you know, because of kind of the way that that's been repeated so often, people lose the context. Like the reason that commandment has force is that Christ is assuming the normal human reaction that you will care about yourself and your family and your neighbor, and then therefore take that and apply elsewhere. But if you don't care about your family, as I said, when your Dickens response, then that commandment kind of loses all meaning when you use it as an excuse to not love the people around you and throw your money in symbolically away while hating everyone right next to you.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a verse that if you're not caring for your own family, you're worse than an unbeliever. So right. It feels like that verse should have some application as well.
Yeah, it's just like you need like a whole context for the Bible and not just a couple choice words whenever you want to use them to further your political agenda. Let's see here. I think glow in the dark here, you might have super chatted one of your responses to someone else in the chat there, but thank you. Then you have your actual questions here. He says, Christians got lazy and took for granted. They got drunk on success in the big getting drunk on success is the big killer of ambition and true lasting success. Flattery dulls the mind given liberally. Evangelicals did that too much. Just getting to the table is the beginning. So let me ask you this. Do you think that a lot of what happened was that Christians have just kind of assumed that we would continue to have this background radiation of Christian culture, that we would all have always have this cultural Christianity. And so therefore they didn't need to stay in charge of certain institutions or forward their beliefs inside certain organizations, because ultimately they kind of got lazy, assuming that that would just always be there for them. And they didn't continue that to their patrimony.
Well, actually, you know, what's funny is you've actually had some of them, like Russell Moore and I'm trying to remember his first name, but an Ortland, one of the Ortland, there's several Ortland pastors. One of them was out arguing that cultural Christianity is bad. If we let cultural Christianity die, it's easier to then be a greater light in the darkness. And that will make it more profitable in the sense of the kingdom to go out and try to save souls. And it was a really convoluted argument, but it was like they were saying, look, if we go ahead and let everything that is moral and just be corrupted, then it will be easier for us to spread the gospel. I mean, it was a really bizarre argument. I didn't understand it, but they've gone so far as, you know, just saying, well, let's just go ahead and let the culture repaganize.
Yeah, that's always a super entitled thing to hear from people. Well, I grew up with a Christian culture and I benefited from, you know, thousands of years of Christendom, you know, shaping a superior way of life. But you know what? You probably don't need that. It's better off if all of your kids have to pick through the ashes of Christian civilization, because ultimately you'll get rid of all the guys who were only going on church to Sunday because they had to. No.
and owning none of why cultural right, Christianity right. has died. I'm like, if the church is being, you know, complete, that only happens if the church is silent and not salty and not spreading any light. So how do you get a dark culture? It's because you've covered up a lot of light.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like a lot of excuses for failed battles. Ultimately just saying at the end of the day, well, you know, just deal with the fact that we've led you to ruin here. Creeper Weirdo says, okay, so do we need to bring in the Freemasons? I don't know. They, of course, we have a lot of Freemasonry symbolism in our founding, but I don't know if that's the answer going forward. Let's see. A little more from Glow in the Dark here. He says, it's always easy to go with the flow. That's what everyone struggles with. Going down the thorny path is needed, which creates a gnashing of teeth. I think that definitely pushes back against goes along with what you're saying about pushing back and not always being nice. For sure here. The problem with joining the elite is becoming one of them. Don't attempt to join them, attempt to change them or lead them on the right path. I think ultimately that is actually a good point. I think we do need a more parallel elitism. I think that's what a lot of people are starting to realize, that sending one or two evangelicals into elite circles turns them into part of the managerial elite, not in the managerial elite into evangelicals. More and more what we need to see are alternative institutions that build up prestige and power inside perhaps a Christian community that can then use that to reach out rather than trying to shove individual Christians into positions of power and expecting them to hold fast to their values.
Yeah, and it does seem like I mean, I know it sounds a little Sisyphean, but we may just have to accept that this is going to be part of the process till, you know, the kingdom comes, is that we will continually build institutions and they will grow because they're ministering to people and speaking truth. And then they will be co-opted and then we have to go and build new institutions.
That's right.
Maybe that's just the cycle.
That and I think that's really important because people get really down on this. They really get very pessimistic because the thing they built doesn't last forever. It's like, well, you were kind of warned that actually none of this will last forever until Christ comes back. So you should probably take that under advisement. And empires will rise, empires will fall. You know, organizations will rise, organizations will fall. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing good.
Right.
And you shouldn't be caring and you shouldn't be taking care of your community and passing it on to your children in the meantime. Don't become a black pillar just because, one particular thing didn't last until Christ got back.
And you don't know what's going to succeed and what isn't. So I still fight for these institutions that seem salvageable, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's good advice. Laura Henry says, apologies on the managerial question. I should have waited. No problem, man. Not an issue at all. Glad we were able to get that out for you. All right, guys. Well, I want to thank Megan, of course, for coming on. Make sure that you pre-order that new book and you are checking out all of her stuff. And of course, if this is your first time on my YouTube channel, go ahead and subscribe. Make sure that you go ahead and turn on notifications, click the bell so you can catch our streams when they go live. If you want to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the Orrin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. And if you've not yet picked up The Total State, make sure that you do that. I'll be appearing on Academic Agent's channel here as soon as I'm done with this broadcast to talk about the book. I'll be on a couple other media hits this week talking about it as well, so make sure to check that out. Thank you, everybody, for watching. And as always, I will talk to you next time.